Okay. We speak really about two topics, if we have time, from the Seder. First one is something unusual that only occurs once in the Chumash, and that is, in this week's Seder, there are two sentences set aside by what appears to be backwards nuns that look like brackets, like two sentences bracketed off. And the Gemara speaks about this, what the significance is, and says basically three ideas that we are going to consolidate into one eventually. First, the Gemara says that these two sentences don't belong here. Really, they should have been written 50 paragraphs earlier. And that 50 parshios, that does not mean 50 sedras. A parsha is a paragraph, either Parsha Stuma, Parsha Psucha, it looks like a paragraph in the Torah. What we call Parsha Sashavua really should be Parshio Sashavua, and the real word for it is a Sedra. But it's almost totally used, Parsha sheet.
With one or two exceptions where Parsha Sashavua is a Parsha.
Right, it's one Parsha, right. The, in any case, so that is one reason. This doesn't belong here. It should be 50 parshios earlier, 50 paragraphs earlier. And therefore the nun. Nun is 50. This doesn't belong here. It belongs 50 earlier. Now the question is, so why did God put it in the wrong place? We're not saying that somebody came along afterwards and changed it. We're saying that really, logically, it fit with what was 50 paragraphs before, about the, what's it called, the how they traveled and how they broke camp and all the different degolim, the different tribe divisions. That's where it should have been. Why did the Rabbanu Shel Olam put it here and not there? So the Gemara says, Lahavdil bein Puranios lePuranios. There were three sins that occurred one after the other. And the Jewish people were, so to say, on a roll for sins. And each one produced a negative result. So to divide, that there shouldn't be three in a row, and the simple idea, I guess, is that three in a row is a chazakah. You don't want to do something three times, right? It makes it two set. So therefore, to divide them up, there shouldn't be three in a row. The Torah took those two sentences from 50 paragraphs before and put them over here. What are the three sins? So, the way some Rishonim learned, the three sins are the following. The first one was, Vayisu Mehar Hashem, that they were at Har Sinai and got most of the Torah on Har Sinai, for almost a year. They got there on Rosh Chodesh Sivan, and they left in Iyar, the next year. And when the word came to leave Har Sinai, the Jews left Har Sinai, Ketinek HaBoreach Mibesa Sefer. They left like children running away from school, running away at the end of the day. Right? I remember when my kids were little, along with Sfiras HaOmer, they used to count Sfiras HaGomer, count anxiously to when school was going to be over. Okay? We know how children, right? I know for sure that's how I felt, the end of a day of school, the end of a year of school, just, freedom. So children run away from school, that's how the Jewish people left Har Sinai. With a sigh of relief. Baruch Hashem, we're getting out of here. A year we've been here, 613 mitzvahs, who knows how many more we'll get if we stay here. Let's get out of here. So they would breathe a sigh of relief, supposedly. We'll see if it's not what happened. That was the first sin. Second sin. God said, okay, let's get to Eretz Yisrael as fast as possible. Because he knows us, and if there's delays, there's always problems. So he kept us going 3 days straight. Traveling, day and night, to get to Eretz Yisrael as fast as possible. And what did Jews start to do? Complain. Started complaining. That was the second sin. The misonanim. Third sin. They started to desire meat, complained about the man, wanted meat, and the Rabban Shem gave them the slav, and we know what happened with that. So to divide between, there shouldn't be three in a row, the Torah separated between the first two. Which is difficult to understand. Because if the idea is there shouldn't be a chazaka, it wasn't necessary to divide by the first two. It was enough to just the second and the third. There is an opinion that two is a chazaka. Rabbi Yehuda. Right? The only other problem is, then it didn't help. Because the first two aren't consecutive, the second two are. So manavshach. If it's that there shouldn't be three, it's sufficient to separate between two and three. If it's there shouldn't be two, then it didn't help. Because there's still two in a row, the last two and three. Now, according to this idea, to separate between the sins, why an upside down nun? So I saw the Kliyoker says a cute thought. We're going to say a different idea eventually, but he says that the word nun in Aramaic means fish. In fact, there is a fish company here in Israel called Nun. Nun is a fish. And therefore, the upside down nun hints to the sin of remembering the fish in Egypt and wanting meat. This is another opinion, third opinion of the Gemara. So those are two opinions. One is that it doesn't belong here, it's 50 parshios out of place, and the reason for it is that to separate between the sins. Second idea is that this is a book to itself. There are not five books of the Torah, there are seven. And then we probably wouldn't call them chumashim, we'd call them shivuyim, I don't know exactly what we'd call them, but there are seven books of the Torah. And these two sentences are a book to themselves. Everything in Bamidbar until these two sentences is another book, and everything after these two sentences is a third book. So the seven books are Bereishis, Shmos, Vayikra, Bamidbar until these two sentences, these two sentences, Bamidbar from these two sentences to the end, and Devarim. And it's based on a pasuk in Tehillim, Chotzva Amudeha Shiva. The Rabbanu Shalom hewed out the pillars of the world to be seven. And the pillars of the world is the Torah. So there's seven books in the Torah. And this two sentences is a book to itself, and we learn halachas from that. That if there's a fire on Shabbos, Rachman Litzlan, and there are Kislei HaKodesh that are in danger of being burnt, so you're allowed to save them. Only if they have at least 85 letters intact. 85 letters is the amount in these two sentences. These two sentences are considered a book in the Torah, so 85 letters is considered significant. The Marsha says, so why the upside down nun? So it's set aside to tell me these are a book. He says, because the Torah contains the 50 gates of wisdom, which is a nun. 50. And I might think that only a long book like Bereishis or Shmos have the 50 gates of wisdom. Comes along the Torah and tells me, no, even these two sentences have all 50 gates of wisdom. That's how deep the Torah is. And it's upside down or backwards because it's very hard to grasp them. 50 gates of wisdom are very hard to grasp. That's the Marsha. That's the background. Now let me tell you what I think. So we have a few questions. First of all, we have some ideas of why the upside down nuns, but the Gemara doesn't say the reason. Secondly, why separate between the first two when it's sufficient to separate between the second and the third? I want to say like this. We've spoken in the past about this concept, mention it again, and then we'll apply it to here. There is a concept that the worst tochacha that a person can get is that he's a self-contradiction. He's not consistent. He's inconsistent. Where do we find that? The Beis Halevi, famous Beis Halevi. Beis Halevi says that, it says that when Yosef confronted his brothers and revealed himself to them, So he said to them, Ani Yosef ha'odavichai. I'm Yosef, my father's still alive. So the Medrash says, Oy lanu miyom hadin, oy lanu miyom hatochacha. They to us from the day of judgment, from the day of rebuke. If the brothers who were older than Yosef couldn't stand up to his rebuke when he rebuked them and said, I'm Yosef, is my father still alive? How can we gonna stand up when God rebukes us in the future? So the Beis Halevi asked, where's the rebuke? Well, he says, I'm Yosef, is my father still alive? Secondly, he asked, why do you have to ask if his father was still alive? It was obvious that Yaakov was alive, otherwise what's Yehuda making such a big deal of taking Binyamin's place and going instead of him, because how's it going to affect his father? His father's not alive, what does he care? Obviously, they believed at least that Yaakov was alive, so what's he asking them? Says the Beis Halevi the following. He says that, he brings a medrash, which he explains first, and then he applies it here. The Medrash says like this. There was once a man who was a total ignoramus. He knew nothing. He didn't even know Aleph Beis. And he wasn't humbled by the fact, but he was taunting Eliyahu HaNavi. So Eliyahu said, look, you can taunt me all you want, mock me, it doesn't bother me. He said, well, you know what bothers me? You don't know anything. You don't know even Aleph Beis. The first question they're going to ask you after 120 years, did you learn Torah? You don't even know the Aleph Beis. Aren't you afraid? He said, no. He said, I have a very good answer. It's all rehearsed. As soon as God poses the question, I'm going to tell him my answer, and God's going to have to admit that I'm right, and he's going to usher me right away into Gan Eden. Eliyahu said, I'm very curious. Let's play Beis Din Shalmala. I'll be the Beis Din Shalmala. You be you. Okay, how come you didn't learn anything? How come you don't even know the Aleph Beis? The guy says, because I'm stupid. I was born with a low IQ. I can't learn. It's not my fault. It's God's fault. He created me. He knows me. Created me stupid. He knows it's true. Right? And because I'm stupid, I can't learn. So Eliyahu says, sounds good. Right? Let me tell you something. What's it called? What do you do for a living? So I'm a fisherman. So could you explain to me what you have to know to be a fisherman? He said, oh, it's not easy. You've got to know a lot of things. He says, first you've got to know how to make nets. So you have to know how to what's it called, process the linen, the flax, and make it into rope, and then how to make the nets, because if you make the holes too big, the fish go through. If you make them too small, the fish see the nets. So you have to make it just right. You have to know where to put it in the river. Too shallow is no good. Too deep is no good. Right in the place where we see the bubbles or whatever, that's where we put the nets. And then we catch the fish, and we clean them, and we sell them. That's how I make my living. So Leo says, interesting. For fishing, God gave you brains to learn how to fish. All this very interesting things to learn. It takes brains to learn it. And for Torah, which it says, Kikaru v'adover ma'ol b'ficho v'vovcha lasoso, God didn't give you brains? Can't be. The guy realizes that he's a self-contradiction. He's not consistent. And he starts to cry. He says, Eliyahu says, don't cry. Everybody has the same excuses. He said, the excuse people are going to say, for instance, why don't you give tzedakah? So people, what's it called? God's not going to give them a big musr shmuz of how important it was to give tzedakah and how come you didn't give tzedakah. He's going to say to them the following. The guy's going to say, I have an excuse. I wasn't rich. I eked out a meager living. What did you expect me to give tzedakah? God's not going to go into a whole tirade of how important tzedakah is. He's going to say to the guy, listen, according to my records, on this and this day, you ate in this restaurant. This was the bill. This was the tip. Right? For a person who doesn't have any money, who couldn't give tzedakah, where'd you get the money for that meal? Right? You're not consistent. For this you have money, for this you don't have money. Or somebody says, I had no time to go to shiurim. I had no time to learn. I was busy day and night or whatever. Again, God's not going to go into a whole tirade of how important it is to learn. He's going to say to the person, very nice, I accept that. But according to my records, on this day, you spent an hour on the phone with your girlfriend, right? I'm talking about women now. What's it called? Speaking about gossip. What's going on in the yeshuv or whatever. You know, for a person who didn't have an hour to go to a shiur, where'd you get the hour to speak Lashon Hara on the phone? So that is going to be the worst kind of musr. So too, says the Beis HaLevi, that's what Yosef told his brothers. I'm Yosef, remember me? Could our father still be alive after what you did to him to me? Right? You're saying now that I should let you go because of your poor father and you're so concerned about your poor old father. Right? Sounds good. You really sound sincere. But remember me, I'm Yosef. Where was your concern for your poor old father when you sold me and came home and told him an animal ate me up? Obviously, when it's convenient for you, you're concerned about your father. And when it's not convenient, you're not. You're very inconsistent. Be consistent. Inconsistency is the worst condemnation. The worst musr, that you're inconsistent. Right? You can do it. Memela was thinking the following. The reason they had to separate between the first two sins is not because they couldn't be a three in a row. Because like we said, then the second and third would have been enough. It's for a different reason completely. The reason is like this. What was the first sin? That they left Har Sinai like children running away from school. Okay? What does that mean, first of all? So the Alter from Slabotka says it means the following. It doesn't mean, like I said before, that when they got the command to leave Har Sinai, they said, well, thank God we're getting out of here because who knows what, how many more mitzvahs we get if we stayed here. That's not what happened. The Jewish people were at a much higher level to even think such a thing. You know what happened? He says the following. Said when they were at the aftermath of Kriyas Yamsuf. So the Egyptians were drowned, and all the wealth they brought with them washed up on the shores of the Red Sea. Tamish. Millions and millions and millions of dollars worth of gold, silver, precious gems were just lining the seashore for the taking. And every Jew got to take whatever he could, right? And there was like an infinite amount over there. So they kept taking more and more, like collecting seashells. Moshe came and he said, God said, time to go. The cloud is moving. We've got to break camp and go home and pack. We're leaving. You know what the people said? Hey, Moshe, how about another half hour? Like, you know, in a half an hour, we can make another few more million dollars over here. So, you know, why don't you tell God we're, you know, let's delay this for half an hour. So Moshe said, I'm sorry. Time to go. Go now. They said, okay, how about 10 more minutes? Moshe said, no, now. 5 minutes, now. And it says, Vayasa Moshe. He had to force them to leave. Didn't want to go. He had to physically take them and force them to break camp and to leave. Because they were hoping they could get another few more diamonds, few more pieces of gold. What should have happened when they broke camp by Har Sinai? Time comes, Moshe says, we've been here almost a year, we've gotten all this Torah, all these mitzvahs, now it's time to go. You know what the Jewish people should have said? Moshe, have another half hour, maybe God will give us another mitzvah. Right, let's stay another half hour, and who knows, maybe we'll get another mitzvah, just like the gold. And Moshe should have said, no, I'm sorry, God said now. And they should have said, well, how about 10 minutes, 5 minutes? They didn't beg. Moshe, God said go. Fine, we'll go. Why now you didn't put up a fight? Because maybe you'll get another mitzvah, but over there you put up a fight, maybe you get another bracelet. For the bracelet you put up a fight, for the mitzvahs not. That's called, for that people on that level, like a child running away from school. That was the idea. So it comes out, they ran away, mamish. They ran from Har Sinai. Okay, God said the following. You have the capacity to run, right? Let's use it for something positive. You have the capacity to run, let's use it for something positive. Let's run to Eretz Yisrael. Instead of running away from Har Sinai, let's run to Eretz Yisrael. We're running already. So let's take the running, turn it into something positive, and run to Eretz Yisrael. What happened? All of a sudden, the Jewish people say, can't do it. Started complaining. My feet hurt. Wait a second. To run away from Har Sinai, no complaints. You can run easily. Feet don't hurt or whatever. To run to Eretz Yisrael, all of a sudden, your feet hurt. That's inconsistency. That can't be. Those two things can't go together. Because they show a total self-contradiction. You have the capacity to run for the negative, but you don't have the capacity to run for the positive. That has to be separated. Not because it shouldn't be three in a row. Because those two things can't go together. And that's why there's upside down nuns. It says in the Gemara in Shabbos that the nun in the Aleph Beis represents ne'emanus. Ne'emanus means faithfulness. There's ne'eman kafuf, ne'eman pashut. Two kinds of ne'emanim. Sometimes you're a ne'eman by being subservient, right? You're faithful by being subservient, and sometimes you're faithful by being dynamic. So there's two kinds of ne'emanus. Ne'eman kafuf, ne'eman pashut. There's two nuns in the Aleph Beis. One is straight down, open, straight, up and down, the final nun. And the nun in the middle of the word, beginning of the word, is bent. But the nun represents faithfulness, which is like consistency. You're faithful, you're consistent to something. They turned that nun's upside down. They weren't faithful. They weren't consistent. Because if you can run for the bad, why can't you run for the good? And if you're selective in when you can run, then you're not a consistent person. That was the sin. That, in my estimation, is what they... I have a completely different idea, but that's not for now. We spoke about already the idea, and it's not the good idea to put it into here. In any case, so that is the that's one idea. The second idea that I want to get to is the end of the Sedra. The end of the Sedra, Miriam speaks Lashon Hara about Moshe Rabbeinu. Okay? She, the background is the following. Eldad and Medad become prophets. Okay? They were supposed to be part of the Sanhedrin, and there was supposed to be, what's it called, from each tribe, right, a certain amount, and there's two extra 70, and there has to be 72 if there were six from every tribe. And so they had two blank, they had 70 papers that said Sanhedrin or Dayan or whatever, and two blanks. And they were all supposed to pick paper, And the ones that got the two blanks, Nebuch, they didn't get the job. There was only 70 jobs or 72 applicants. So Eldad and Medad said, we're being mevater. We're not even going to go. Let the other 70 get it, and we're willing to not assert ourselves. Because of that, they were rewarded. And they became prophets. Prophets. And their prophecy, they started prophesying that Moshe is going to die and Yeshua is going to bring him to Eretz Israel. Which both Yehoshua and Moshe's son were not very happy to hear. So they went to Moshe and they said, you know, Eldad and Medad are saying this prophecy. And Yehoshua said, put him in prison, right? And they shouldn't say such things or whatever. And Moshe said, what do you care? Halavai that all of Klal Yisrael should be Nevi'im. You think I'm jealous of them? That what's it called? That I want to hog all the prophecy? Let them be prophets too. Halavai, everybody should be prophets. So, when they became prophets, Miriam was sitting next to her sister-in-law, Yocheved. Tzipora, right. Tzipora, Moshe's wife. And this was after the giving of the Torah. So Miriam said, how nice, Eldad and Medad became prophets. So Tzipporah said, yeah, but I feel bad for their wives. And I said, what do you feel bad for their wives for? He said, well, you know that Moshe Rabbeinu, since he became a prophet and got the Torah, he's separated himself from me. We're divorced, basically. He doesn't live with me anymore. Miriam said, what are you talking about? She said, that can't be the reason. Because we're prophets, myself and Aaron, we haven't separated from our spouses. You don't have to separate from your spouse if you're a prophet. Right? There's something fishy in Moshe Rabbeinu's home, and we've got to find out what the Shalom Bayis problem is. Right? Because it can't be that it's because of his prophecy. So she went, and she spoke to her brother Aaron. Something's wrong in Moshe Rabbeinu's Shalom Bayis. We've got to work on this, see what to do. Immediately, the Rabbanu Shel Olam called all of them together because Miriam basically spoke Lashon Hara about Moshe. What was the Lashon Hara? First of all, that there seems to be a Shalom Bayis problem, but the reason that she assumed there was a Shalom Bayis problem is because why in the world would Moshe separate from his wife because of his prophecy? We're also prophets. That means she equated her level of prophecy with Moshe's and didn't understand there's a difference between them. Ultimately, what was the difference? This is all background. We're not getting into it. What was the difference? The difference is, basically, that Moshe Rabbeinu's prophecy was of such a nature that he didn't have to lose control over his physical side and become like in a trance. Other prophets had to do that. They went into a trance, they lost complete control over their physical bodies, they began to shake like people who have some kind of spasms because they can't control their muscles, and because their physical and spiritual side separated. They were like in a total trance, and that's why the Nevi'im were called Meshugoyim, because they looked like crazy people shaking when they gave their prophecy. Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't like that. Moshe Rabbeinu's prophecy was on such a high level that he could talk to you and at the same time be talking to God. He was in total control of his physical faculty, and he spoke to God like he spoke to somebody else, in total control, right? Didn't have to give up his physical side, therefore. Other prophets whose physical side didn't take part in their prophecy didn't have to be pure physically when they had a prophecy, because their physical side and spiritual side were totally separated. But Moshe Rabbeinu, whose physical side took part in his prophecy, had to be spiritually pure, physically pure. And therefore, he couldn't live with his wife, because having relations creates tumah, right? And because of that, not that the relations is tumah, it just creates tumah. That's the, and therefore he had to be always ready to speak to God. And he couldn't wait and say, I got to go to the mikveh. So the Maisa, therefore he had to separate from his wife. He did it on his own. God agreed with him. Okay. So it was really, that was the reason. But Miriam didn't understand that. She didn't understand there was a significant difference between her prophecy and Moshe's, and that is one Lashon Hara, that she spoke derogatorily about Moshe Rabbeinu's level of prophecy. She also was suspicious that there was something wrong, therefore, otherwise, Shalom bias-wise, and she spoke to Aaron. Now, what should she have done? She always did speak to Aaron. She should have gone to Moshe first and spoke to him, not to speak to Aaron about Moshe. So it constituted Lashon Hara. So Miriam was punished. She became a Metzora. Okay, she became a Metzora. We have a mitzvah to remember what Miriam did, So we remember how bad it is to speak Lashon Hara. Even Miriam, right? Great Miriam spoke Lashon Hara, look what happened to her. Now on the surface, that seems a little incongruous. Because what are we doing? Every time we remember what Miriam did, we're speaking Lashon Hara about Miriam. So you remember, don't speak Lashon Hara. How? By speaking Lashon Hara about Miriam. One question. Second question is, the Medrash says that in the Schus, that Miriam waited for her little brother when he was in the basket. And she stood there and risked her life. Because if somebody would have found, what are you doing looking at that little basket in the Nile? And they would have discovered that she was a sister to somebody who tried to countermand Paro's decree of killing these babies. She would have been executed too, as an accomplice. So she risked her life to stand there and see what's happening with her little brother. Because she waited to see what happened to her little brother. The whole Jewish people waited for her now. When she was sent out of the camp because she was a Metzora, so the people were supposed to, they were supposed to break camp and leave, and instead, they waited 7 days for Miriam. Now think about that. It doesn't make any sense. Right? Nobody knew what Miriam did, except for her two brothers and God and her. That was it. It was a... Right? It could be silent. Right, yeah, right, right. But he knew afterwards because he prayed for her. Right. Right. The only fact that Miriam was a Metzora, right, and therefore Moshe knew backwards what happened, was the four people. It was a very private family affair. Now, don't you think it would be better for Miriam if nobody knew? The people travel, they didn't realize Miriam's not there. 7 days later, God would give her a fast horse to catch up, right, give her Kfitzas HaDerech, she'd sneak back into the camp at night, and nobody would ever know that anything happened to Miriam. Wouldn't that be better? Instead, God said, no, we're going to do Miriam a big favor. In the schus that she waited for her brother, right? Everybody's going to wait for Miriam. Now, everybody knows that Miriam's out of the camp. She's a Metzora because she spoke Lashon Hara about her brother. Great schus for Miriam, right? Now, her sin is publicized to the whole Klal Yisrael. That's a schus. Now we're giving you a reward, Miriam, because you were such a good girl, right? You're going to get a reward. What? The whole people are going to know about your sin. That doesn't make sense. Therefore, I want to say the following. Miriam, the Rambam seems to say this clearly, Miriam did not sin willfully. She made a mistake, at best. It was totally, she fell into this Lashon Hara by mistake. Why? First of all, she loved her little brother. She wasn't going to hurt him. She thought there was something wrong in his family. She wanted to help him. Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't harmed by this. Moshe on of the Torah goes out of his way to say Moshe was so humble, if he had heard what she said, it wouldn't have bothered him. Didn't have any effect on Moshe Rabbeinu. Not personally, it didn't affect his job, right? He didn't get fired because Miriam spoke Lashon Hara about him. Zero effect on Moshe, and she didn't mean anything bad. She only meant good. She made a mistake. She should have discussed it first with Moshe before she went to her brother. That's all she did, was speak to her brother about, she loved her brother. She wanted to hurt him. So then, why was she punished? The answer is, because Lashon Hara is so devastating, it's not a punishment because you did something bad. It's a natural result. A person was given speech, and that's what makes him human. And the ultimate speech is Torah. Spoke about this a few weeks ago, I think. Ultimate speech is Torah, which man was given speech to create. It's his neshama is represented by the speech. And if you use your speech in a way that is negative, so you're basically destroying your humanity. You're a dead person. It's like a Metzora. That's what we spoke about in Parshas Metzora. That's Soras. You basically show that you've killed yourself. You've committed suicide. Because you've taken your speech, which is your humanity, and instead of using it for something positive, you're using it in a totally negative way for Lashon Hara. Okay. So it's not a punishment. It's just that speaking Lashon Hara basically makes a person a living dead person. It's a metzias. I think I've said this story here before, but it brings out the point, so I'm going to say it again. You can't have heard it more times from me than I have, so another time won't hurt. When I was in Miami, somebody asked me, why don't I say stories from Matityahu? Because they still pay my salary. In Miami, I can tell you any story I want, nothing to do with them. But after I retire from Matatyahu. I'll tell you stories about Matatyahu too. But in any case, in Miami, I once had the following shaila. A doctor, very Choshevim, just moved here to Eretz Yisrael, to the north. A plastic surgeon came to me. He had a very big shaila. He wanted to know if he had a bench coma. What was the shaila? He reconstructed what had happened. His wife was cleaning the kitchen with bleach. And in those days, bleach came in glass bottles, if you remember what a glass bottle is. Okay. And she was cleaning, and she knocked over the bottle, and it broke. But it didn't break where all the bleach spilled out. It broke across the top. So it was a jagged edge on the top, but and the bleach was still intact, most of it, but she couldn't use that bottle. It was very dangerous. So she decided, I'm not pouring out this bleach. She poured the bleach into a Coke bottle, and she left it on the floor. Okay, now we have a bottle, a Coke bottle of bleach on the floor. Comes home one of the children, and he sees a Coke bottle of bleach on the floor. So he figures he's going to do his mother a favor. He doesn't know it's a Coke bottle of bleach, a Coke bottle with liquid in it. He doesn't look, and he takes it, and he puts it in the refrigerator. Now there is a Coke bottle of bleach in the refrigerator. The husband came home from a tennis match, very overheated and thirsty. And he didn't have time to open the refrigerator door completely. He just opened a little bit, put his hand in, felt around for the first Coke bottle, got it, put it to his lips. Baruch Hashem, when it hit his lips, he realized this was not new Coke, old Coke, you know, it wasn't even Tempo. This was something different. Right. He didn't drink it. It just touched his lips, and at that point he realized this isn't Coke. Baruch Hashem. Now what would we say? If he had drunk it, nothing would have happened. Why? Because his wife just wanted to save money. She wasn't interested in murdering her husband. The child just wanted to do her mother a favor. She didn't want to kill her father. The guy was not interested in committing suicide. He just wanted to quench his thirst. Nobody had any bad intentions over here. It was just a bad mistake. Therefore, it wouldn't have caused any damage. Wrong. Had he drunk the Coke, right, it would have burned his kishkas out. So even though nobody had any bad intentions. Right, I drunk the bleach, right. The Coke is probably much worse for your sister. There used to be a rumor that if you put nails in Coke, they would dissolve after.
Put teeth in Coke. And they go disintegrate.
Really?
Right.
But that's only Coke, not RC. In any case, so that's not true. Even though nobody had any bad intentions, but if you drink bleach, it makes an impression on you. Same thing over here. Even though you don't mean anything bad, you fell into Lashon Hara, but it was Lashon Hara, then it's devastating. Therefore, Torah said like this, we're not speaking Lashon Hara about Miriam. Miriam had no bad intentions. It was totally a mistake, an accident, right? Not at all with any bad intention. But what we're learning from Miriam is, look what happens with Lashon Hara, even when there's no bad intention. So if you understand that, it's not Lashon Hara against Miriam. Right? But in order to do that, you have to understand it. The proof to this is that Moshe Rabbeinu davened for Miriam. What did he say? Kael na refon Allah. Every time Moshe davened that people should be forgiven for sins, he said, Slachna, Sana, not refona. Here, it wasn't a question of having kapara for a sin. It was that she should be healed from the result of what was a natural result of speaking Lashon Hara. It wasn't that she needed atonement for a sin. It was that the effect affected her. Now, therefore, it's a schus, it's a merit for Miriam to learn from her how bad Lashon Hara is, if you know that she didn't really have any bad intention. But if there's a havamina that she had a bad intention, then better we shouldn't know about this, because then it's Lashon Hara. Therefore, the Torah says like this. The entire nation waited for Miriam and knew that she was a Metzora and learned this lesson. But God said, if there was any doubt that she meant this maliciously, right, even a Havamina, then that wouldn't happen. Then we'd have to do it secretly, nobody should know, because otherwise it would be Lashon Hara about Miriam. How do we know that she didn't mean anything malicious? Because she risked her life for this little baby brother. She risked her life. Does it make any sense to think that now she's going to speak maliciously against that same brother she risked her life for when he was a baby? Therefore, since she waited for Moshe, and it was obvious from that that she'd never say anything malicious against him with the intent of hurting him, now the whole place can wait for her. And it's a good thing for Miriam that everybody's going to learn how bad Lashon Hara is, and it's not going to reflect anything negative on Miriam, because poor Miriam made a mistake. She had all good intentions, she made a mistake. That's not Lashon Hara against Miriam. But the only way we know that is because we know for sure she never would have spoken maliciously against her. How do we know that? Because she risked her life when she was a baby. Therefore, it was a schus for her only because it was clear that she meant nothing malicious. That's the idea. There's another medrash that makes sense according to this also. The medrash says that Moshe Rabbeinu said the shortest tefillah in history for his sister, right? Kael Norafon Olam. He didn't say, you know, long tefillahs for the Jewish people. He had to have them for 40 days and 40 nights. Pretty long tefillah in years. So why didn't he daven long for her? So the Medrash says, people shouldn't say his sister is suffering and he's saying long tefillahs. Meaning the following, that, you know, people reflect how other people look at them. That's how they look at them. That people, somebody doesn't like you, you don't like them. It's like the mayim ponim upon him. It's a reflection. Had Moshe Rabbeinu said a long tefillah for Miriam, first of all, it would have appeared like he's davening that she should not be healed, but be forgiven. That's, you need a lot more tefillah for that, all the tefillahs he did for the forgiveness. Secondly, it would have looked like he's not sensitive to his sister's pain. That means that there's a little malicious feeling between them, right? Otherwise, get it over with and get her healed fast. Now, if Moshe has malicious feelings against his sister, Mistama, she had malicious feelings against him. And then it's going to look like Shitaka sinned, and not just fell into this Lashon Hara totally innocently. And then it would have been Lashon Hara against her. So therefore the Rabbanu Shlom said to Moshe Rabbeinu, look, cut it short, right? Make it clear that you're not davening that she be forgiven, rather that she be healed, and show that you're very sensitive, that you want her healed immediately, you don't want her to suffer. And then it's obvious that she doesn't want you to suffer either, because it reflects one the other. And now we can use her as a model for Lashon Hara, because it's no longer negative against Miriam. It's merely, look what happens when you speak Lashon Hara. Even if you don't mean anything bad, you only mean good, and it's totally an accident, a mistake. That's what we learn from.